So I mean, but I wanted, this is a piece by Vito Acconci, untitled from some point in the late 1960s, and I wanted it as an example both of a sort of self-reflexive, self-descriptive collapse of form and content, but also as an example of the cultural force of the most minute, seemingly incidental material aspects of a text as part of series of poetic explorations that Acconci was undertaking at the time with sort of standard typewriter page as an arena for performance and action, which means that the version that you have printed on this A4 sheet is no longer accurate. It's totally false. Right, it's 0.23 inches narrower and 0.69 inches longer than the standard U.S. letter size sheet that Acconci constructed it for. So there's a 63 square inch difference in area. There's a 0.46 linear inch difference. This is because, right, the A4 size that you have, right, based on the square root of 2, so the paper cut in half is similar to itself. They're scalable dimension. So your page is abstractly self-reflexive within that A series of trims in the way that Acconci's piece is thematically self-reflexive. And this is a popular late 18th century math problem, and an idea for this kind of trim standard goes back at least to Georg Lichtenberg, who pioneered investigations also into electrostatic phenomenon. So those investigations led directly to the photocopier, for which the A4 type paper sizing he proposed is perfectly suited, right? It's scalable so that you can have two open book pages in a ratio to fit perfectly into a single sheet. Although the A4 comes to us not directly from Lichtenberg, but from the 1922 German Deutsches Institut für Normung 476. So it has its root in these ideologies of Prussian efficiency and industrialization, which, as we know, also have other more sinister histories as well. It's adopted as ISO 216. UK adopts it in 1959. It is a standard everywhere in the world except for Canada and the United and the United States, and it has only actually partial adoption in Mexico. So, the point being, right, that the misprinting of Acconci's poem, or however you think about it, the scrupulous reprinting of the text without taking into account the work, raises all sorts of questions about standardization and globalization, the forms that international corporate bureaucracy took by capital in the 20th century, as well as the issues of nationalism, histories of empire, of colonization, and just the ideology of the natural size of a piece of paper, what the natural habitat for literature might be, what prose in an unmarked state looks like. And Acconci's work resonates with conceptual arts realization in the 1960s, that first that a work could be self-descriptive, also that an artwork could be made of language, and so that language could describe itself. In some ways, the exemplary case for this being Dan Graham's 1966 poem schema, which enumerates the formal and grammatical properties of its printed instantiation. Dan Graham has a preface in which the piece explains itself before explaining itself. He says that the schema, quote, is for a set of pages whose component variants are to be published in various places. In each published instance, it is set in its final form, so it defines itself, by the editor of the particular publication where it is to appear, the exact data used to correspond in each specific instance to the specific facts of the final published appearance. The work defines itself in place only as information, with simply the external support of the facts of its external appearance or presence in print in place of an object. So specifically, the schema asks for things like the number of adjectives, the number of adverbs, the percentage of area occupied by type, the number of columns, the depth of depression of type into the page surface, still using letterpress in 1966, the number of letters of the alphabet, the number of lines, perimeter of the page, the weight of the paper sheet, the number of point size type, the name of the typeface, and so on. The complete text was published in about a half dozen art journal periodicals and experimental poetry journals. Graham tried to get it published in sort of glossier places like Esquire, but was not as successful. And for each publication, then the editor of the journal would provide all of that information about the physical support and the typography and adjust the tally accordingly. So Graham submits this template. It's not unlike, actually, the XML portion of a source that's used to order and display the information you pull from an internet database. But what he retrieves is this assembled poem. And with each publication, as Graham explained it, quote, a page of schema exists as a matter-of-fact materiality. It's a measure of itself as place. It takes its own measure of itself as a place, that is, placed two-dimensionally on or as a page. So, for instance, when the work's published in the inaugural issue of Art Language, it was printed in Press Roman typeface, and so the entry listing then the number of capitalized words was two, so Press and Roman. Also had two capitalized words when it's published in the anthology Possibilities of Poetry, where it's printed in Aster type, but on Dondel paper stock, so the capital A and D. But the entire process, which seems so mechanical, seems just a matter-of-fact materiality, is rarely so straightforward. When it's published in Aspen magazine, it's printed in Univers 55 typeface, but the entry for the capital words mysteriously is three. Maybe with the editor thinking that the 55 is a capitalized compound, two capital F's, 55, though it's printed numerically, but in recognition of the fact that Univers was the first typeface to incorporate numbers as part of its name, or maybe the subtitle poem should be considered capitalized, though that still leaves some word unaccounted for, or suggests that the number should be four. The editor, in any event, doesn't consider Graham's name to be capitalized or to be part of the text or the work's title. There's no easy resolution, and the accounting is similarly perplexing in other instances. I won't bore you with all the details, but it is surprisingly unintuitive. You think that this would be the easiest poem to construct, and no one seems able to construct it in a way that it is in fact accountable for itself. And indeed, all different versions proliferate, but so do the problems. So does letters of the alphabet refer to the total number of characters on the page, or to the 26 letters of the alphabet? Does paper sheet refer to a brand or a weight or to a description of the sheet, and so on? So part of the work's effect, it seems, is to explore the sort of heiseity, the thisness that makes something a particular thing, is relevant to those birds, or the birds that aren't there. By complicating here the seemingly straightforward facticity of self-description and focusing attention on these otherwise overlooked material details. So Graham's piece is rigorously and recursively self-referential, but it's not as simple as it seems. And I want to suggest that when content parses its form in this way, there's always going to be this inference remainder. Let's skip a little bit here. And also claim that the result focuses attention on these minute particulars of the physical support of language, but with implications that extend beyond it. That the medium Graham, I think, concurs with McLuhan is the message. And that message is that material and cultural forms predate and anticipate and deform whatever individual expressive content might seek expression through their channels. So the poem schema defines itself as place, as it defines the limits and contingencies of placement, that by enclosing context, you get an enclosed content. Graham explains that under such conditions, there is no author, there is no hierarchy of versions, there is no composition. The contingent situation of publication determines the final form. There's no attempt to recreate or represent an authorial insight. There is no interior. The conventional, linear, part-by-part reading logic is eliminated. I think similarly, without interior and without hierarchy are the self-referential paintings that Mel Ramsden did in the late 1960s. They're all entitled 100% Abstract, which brings this kind of recursive logic to the medium of paint, and enunciates this move, as Christian suggested, from works seeking some kind of embodied viewership to works looking for a mental thinkership. And so compared with even the most austere Ad Reinhardt-like abstractions, which invite one to gaze at paint on newspaper, in Reinhardt's case, but paint on canvas, that Ramsden's abstracts offer information about the paint itself. So they aim at greater abstraction through increasing specificity. One of the neatly lettered paintings from 1968 contains copper bronze powder, 12%, acrylic resin, 7%, aromatic hydrocarbons, 81%. Or another from the same year, which is a little more slyly anti-retinal, has blue letters on a beautiful gray background and reads titanium calcium, 83%, silicates, 17%. Though, again, the details, they're not as straightforward as they seem. The matter-of-fact materiality, not so matter-of-fact, because the chemicals there, calcium sulfate with a whitening agent of titanium dioxide, 83% titanium calcium, and the silicate extenders, the 17% silicates, indicate not the paint of the lettering that you're looking on, but actually the acrylic gesso primer that's invisible beneath the text, but nonetheless an essential part of the painting. And I want to talk about those sort of essential parts. I wanted to ask a similar question of literature, and thought that this would be really the... this would be great, that this is going to be the easiest poem I'd ever written. And I would go to the Xerox machine, and I would take out the canister of pigment, and I'd just read off what the chemicals were. But it turned out it's all proprietary information. And so I spent really about 6 months requesting shareholders' reports from companies, and then looking at the suppliers for materials and getting their chemical danger sheets that governments make them issue, and constructed a piece that I called Fact that just enumerates the material chemical support of the page. And they did several other versions for different publications. It turns out you use different kinds of trees in Europe for your printing, so I had to adjust the percentages of spruce used and things like that. I think we're going to screen now a version for film, and then I'll talk a little bit more about why I find this work so politically upsetting. So if we can dim and screen.
Back a bit.
Thank you. So that was true. And as I want to talk about the kind of fraught social histories that get embedded in the matter-of-fact materiality of film, but going back to a discussion of those histories by Hollis Frampton in 1979 in a lecture at the Whitney, where he's trying to make visible the hidden social histories of aesthetics. He says that if the Romans had not practiced slavery in Spain, the sulfide of mercury called cinnabar would never have been found in quantity in the Mediterranean, and the certain reds that we treasure in the painting of the Renaissance would not be around to this day. And I mean, he doesn't go further, but you know, so you could look at something like a Renaissance painting of a biblical scene like the flight from Egypt, and be looking at a depiction of slavery and the material byproduct of slavery at the same time. The figures represented on the panel unable to escape the economic conditions that make the representation possible in the first place, and which accounts, in fact, for the value that kept the work preserved for centuries for us to see. And Frampton is also arguing for the hidden, congealed cost of the work of art. This is, you know, it's very cheap. People talk about how expensive film is, but it's very cheap to write a symphony from the composer's point of view, but to hire 120 people for 6 weeks and put them in a big building and heat the building and so forth, the cost adds up. And he also says that in an economic environment that tends to demand that nothing of value be printed in small quantities, whole forests fell for Saul Bellow to become a Nobel laureate, for example. Vast tracts of Idaho were the raft that floated Mr. Bellow to Sweden on that occasion. He says that old, that's good, old film support, cellulose nitrate, was military fallout. It was gun cotton, very simply. Large manufacturing technology existed to produce the stuff in quantity. The flexibility and transparency of the stuff were what was at issue in this case, not its explosiveness, but that has continued to be a problem. Nitrate, as we know, still undergoes a slow-motion explosion, and 19th century military technology is, after all, working its revenge upon the early cinema silently in millions of dark tins all over the West. Again, Frampton doesn't quite propose this, but I want to follow that thinking through a bit and suggest that, you know, if you watch a battle scene in some Civil War costume movie, that you're watching then the history of cinema itself. Or in the case of something like Birth of a Nation, you're watching the film of the film itself, that you're seeing the future of the substrate sped up over years and compressed into every rifle shot or every explosion. So you have a certain collapse of theme and content, like the other more austere and less figurative work that we screened. Frampton goes on and says that the emulsifying or suspending agent is gelatin, that is rendered animal parts. The Eastman Kodak Company still insists that the very best photographic gelatin is made from selected ear and cheek clippings of Argentine beef cattle that are fed on mustard greens. This is in fact true. It has to do with the sulfide content that the mustard supplies that goes into the film and lets it feed at the proper rate. But that gelatin could only become available in quantity, Frampton says, after a specific economic moment had been reached in the West. That was the development of vast latifundia for the raising of beef cattle in the Western United States and the Argentine. The gelatin was, again, a fallout from a process of exploitation of an entirely different kind. And finally, there was the brief moment during which the photographic industries fastened upon silver halide technology as the material basis of the image, which proceeded also from an unusual circumstance, and that was the great silver strikes of the 1870s and 80s in Colorado and in Idaho, which released vast quantities of that element into the market within the period of a decade. The total quantity of silver in the world increased by something like 3 decimal orders of magnitude over the time. And just to put this in perspective, the amounts of silver in film are small but not incidental. We saw 16 millimeter film, but 35 millimeter film has about 2 or 3 grams of silver per minute. So it's about current rates. That's about 100 pounds a minute. Of silver, or $150 a minute. Frampton continues, nevertheless, it had always been rare, and it was made available again briefly and in quantity through a process of real estate exploitation. Now, again, Frampton doesn't pursue the thematic implications of this, but I think one of which is how suddenly and persistently resonant the genre of the Western becomes. So all the Hollywood narratives about conflicts between miners and cowboys and ranchers are not just adventure stories, but suddenly the story of the substrate of film itself, the history of the invention of the cinema. So that if you watch the cattle stampede in Red River, say, a 1948 film with John Wayne and Montgomery Cliff, I think, is in there, or any right this cattle stampede set piece in Westerns, you're watching cattle with this kind of strange double vision, the image of the cattle depicted by the exposed film, and then all that bovine gelatin that is making those images visible at all. And this is a situation that that obtains to all material and media, and I'm going to just end by thinking of what something like the DVD version of Fact would be like. There's a very interesting article on labor and the figuration of labor and the concealment of labor in video games by, specifically in The Sims, by Mackenzie Wark, who notes that computer processors, so video game consoles and personal computers, rely on semiconductors, which rely on tantalum, which is very good conductor of heat and electricity. And Wark explains, the tantalum was quite possibly refined from coltan, short for columbite tantalite, dug out of the ground in the Congo, which has plenty. The Okapi Faunal Reserve in the Congo, home to gorillas, monkeys, elephants, as well as the okapi, some kind of rare relative of the giraffe. Thousands of Mbuti or pygmies also live there, and their livelihood is compromised by the coltan miners who dig what one journalist called SUV-sized holes in the mud, out of which they can extract about a kilo of coltan a day. A kilo of coltan is worth about $80 during the height of the technology boom. In fact, there's a world shortage of the stuff which delayed even the release of PlayStation 2. And Wark's point is that the abstracted, detached, cleanly virtual world of the game space is implicated in these global logistics that make modern corporate capital function, and that the clean, well-lit, rule-bound, logical space of the video game is inextricably bound to a very dirty, ugly material world. And I want to again just push those insights and reminders about media back toward narrative. So if someone playing an Xbox shooter about African mercenaries is actually reenacting the very sorts of real violence that the sale of coltan funded in the civil war that followed the collapse of the Seyseseku regime in the Congo, or that the virtual landscape that's produced in that tangible geographic world are not only analogous but are somehow coexisting. There's an old Mac computer game entitled Congo, which is the ultimate first-person jungle adventure. As a special operative for the Travicom conglomerate, you can venture deep into the unexplored Congo on a quest for rare diamonds hidden within the legendary city of Zinj. Astonishing special effects and 3D graphics plunge you headlong into this deadly gauntlet. Experience exotic jungles, raging rivers, subterranean caves, active volcanoes, and deadly adversaries. Armed with an arsenal of high-tech devices, you must rely on strategy, quick thinking, and puzzle-solving skills to survive. Hang on for an unforgettable adventure where you are the endangered species. And those endangered species, then, the gorillas, monkeys, elephants, and giraffes come back in games like Zoo Tycoon, where you can conserve the very animals in animated representations that are killed and endangered by the game that makes those representations possible. So there's this sort of sickening irony in that the materials displacing certain species, these elements and materials that are themselves displaced in very small quantities to your microprocessor, permit those animals to return as these ghostly virtual images in a simulacrum of the zoo that might save them. So in a sense, I just want to say that the violence of the adventure game Congo or the exiled gorillas and zoo tycoon are what you're looking at every time you turn on your computer. Okay, that's enough.